Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
With DashPass from DoorDash, get more to your door for less. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With no delivery fees and savings on every order. Dash that with DashPass from DoorDash. Start your 30-day free trial now. Terms and conditions apply.
Where do I see myself in 5 years? I want to buy a camper van. With a sweet solar-powered kitchenette. And space for my best friend, too. Yes, you.
Let's get started on your 5-year plan. CIBC, ambitions made real.
Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. Hollywood Exiles, from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nigel Adderley, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 11th of February, these are our main stories. A 6-year-old girl who went missing in Gaza last month has been confirmed dead. Tension remains high in Pakistan as the country awaits the delayed results of Thursday's election. The two biggest parties are both claiming victory. Two of Hungary's leading female politicians, including the president Katalin Novak, have resigned over their decision to pardon a man jailed for covering up child abuse. Also in this podcast.
In the end, we have two Arab teams from this region making it to the final. The stadium was full, and this is something which doesn't happen here very often.
Qatar has retained football's Asian Cup by beating Jordan on home turf. We begin in Gaza, and the story of Hind Rajab, which captured the imagination of many people around the world. Nearly 2 weeks ago, the 6-year-old Palestinian was in a car with relatives when it came under fire in Gaza City. She called the rescue services saying, "I'm so scared, please come." They were some of the last words heard from her. On Saturday, her death was confirmed. A short time after this news emerged, our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson filed this report from Jerusalem.
There are some 28,000 people who are now thought to have been killed in Gaza. And this is the story of just one little girl, but it's really captured attention, I think, because of those audio recordings that were made public of her asking for help, and also because of this shrinking glimmer of hope that she might still be alive. 12 days after the family car she was travelling in came face to face with Israeli tanks, Israel's army today pulled back from that area of Gaza City and rescue workers went in. Witnesses say that dozens of bodies were recovered from the streets and buildings there. One of them, they say, was Hind.
A child's voice, alone in the midst of war. Hiding in her uncle's car, among the bodies of her relatives, the last hours of 6-year-old Hind Rajab were dominated by one plea. Come and get me. Recordings of her calls with emergency services sparked a 12-day campaign to find her. Today, as Israeli forces left the area in Gaza City, paramedics went in. They found Hind's body with those of her relatives in the black Kia car she'd been travelling in, its front shattered, bullet holes scattered across its side.
We found 6 decomposed bodies, including girls, women and one man. The girl, Hind, she was identified among the decomposed bodies, indicating they had been subjected to gunfire and shelling. Here are the martyrs. Now they are all bones.
The dead, badly damaged and decomposed, were buried quickly. No funeral, just grief and anger. And from Hind's mother Wissam, a demand that someone be held accountable.
For every person who heard my voice, my daughter's pleading voice, yet did not rescue her. I will question them before God on the day of judgment. Netanyahu, Biden, and all those who collaborated against us, against Gaza and its people. I pray against them from the depth of my heart.
Hind is one of thousands of children killed in 18 weeks of war in Gaza.
What are you waiting for? Hind was killed. How many more mothers are you waiting for to feel this pain? How many more children do you want to get killed?
Near where Hind was found was the ambulance car that was sent to get her. The bodies of its crew members, Yusuf Al-Zeno and Ahmed Al-Madoun, still inside. Nibal Farsakh, a spokeswoman for the Palestinian Red Crescent, said Yusuf and Ahmed had radioed in as they approached to say they could see Hind in the car before the line was cut in a burst of gunfire.
They were deliberately targeted, although our ambulance have very clearly the Red Crescent emblem on top of our ambulances, and we had it clearly also on all sides of the ambulance.
Nibal Farsakh told me it had taken several hours to agree coordination with the Israeli army to allow the ambulance through. We asked Israel's army about this, but received no response.
The sounds of Hind is still here in my ear and in all of our staff while she was appealing for us over 3 hours. Please come and get me. Please come and get me. We felt helpless at that point, and we tried our best to coordinate our safe access.
At the hospital where she waited for news of her daughter, Hind's mother Wissam still holds the little pink bag she was keeping for her. Inside, a notebook where Hind had been practicing her handwriting. The six-year-old was killed days ago. Today, it was hope that died.
Lucy Williamson. In Tel Aviv on Saturday, thousands demonstrated against the government's handling of efforts to bring home from Gaza the Israeli hostages taken by Hamas on October the 7th. It's believed there are around 130 hostages still being held captive. These protesters challenge Prime Minister Netanyahu's argument that total victory against Hamas in Gaza is the best way to bring them home.
We trust him according to his own private interest and not for us. And this is very sad, very sad.
We believe in the importance of human life here, and we understand that the human life here is important in both sides. And so if the ceasefire is going to bring back home the hostages, that's, I think, what we should do.
In my opinion, and I think I represent many, about the fact that he is not interested in the destiny of the kidnapped at all. All he's interested in, first place, is to stay in power and keep on forever for the last day upon earth.
In a separate development, Israel has carried out an airstrike almost 40 miles into Lebanon, apparently to target a key Palestinian figure close to Hamas. He is said to have survived, although three people were reportedly killed, including a fighter with the Iranian-backed Hezbollah group. And there have been almost daily cross-border exchanges of fire between Hezbollah and Israel since November. It's thought this attack was far deeper into the Lebanese territory than normal. The Israeli military has yet to comment on the strike. In the past week, the United States has carried out a series of air raids that have killed 17 Iranian-backed militiamen in Iraq, as well as a precision drone strike in the capital, Baghdad, that killed a senior commander. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Gurin, is in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad.
It's been a very tense week. There is a real feeling here of concern that one miscalculation could cause a disaster. What's happening here is that Iraq is getting caught in the crossfire between US forces and Iranian-backed militia that operate on Iraqi soil. Now, the beginning of the current escalation was the killing of three US troops in Jordan. That was carried out by Iranian-backed militia. The US vowed that they would retaliate, and we have seen that retaliation playing out in Syria, but also here in Iraq, where we had the strikes, first wave of strikes that killed 17 militia fighters. But then we had that surgical strike on the streets of Baghdad here, which targeted a senior militia commander, turning his jeep into a fireball. Now, the government is very concerned, and not just the government, I have to say, many other people we have spoken to share this concern that the tit-for-tat that is taking place here could push Iraq into a conflict. Now, since the killing of the militia leader, the militia group here, there's an umbrella grouping calling itself the Islamic Resistance in Iraq, and these are pro-Iranian militia. They have come out and said they are going to step up their attacks against US forces. On the other hand, the Americans are saying we will continue to take necessary steps to protect our own people. Now, a key flashpoint here is the presence of US troops. They're here at the invitation of the government. There are about 2,500. They're not in a combat role. They are advisors. And they've been here since 2014 to help prevent a resurgence of the so-called Islamic State. But when I sat down with Iraq's foreign minister, Fuad Hussein, I asked him if the government now wants US troops out.
We want to have to start the negotiation. On the basis of the negotiation, it will be decided. And of course, the end of the negotiation must be clear. The majority of Iraqi people, they don't want to have foreign forces on Iraqi soil.
But is it Iraqi government policy now that the troops should go and it's just a question of when?
The troop one day must leave. This country, at the end, must be free from having foreign bases. Some has been invited, and that's valid for the American side. Some has not been invited.
Going back to the issue of the US strikes that happened, the Americans say they were targeting Iraqi militia that are pro-Iranian, that are on your soil, and from your soil, they are carrying out attacks on US forces. Do you accept that there are militias here that are officially part of your security forces, but in fact are armed and trained by Iran that are carrying out these attacks?
Those militias, they themselves, they are announcing their attacks. And they are also well known that they are or they have good connection with the Iranian side. This is well known. I cannot deny it. That's true.
As we sit here now, Minister, is it the case that your government does not have control over these pro-Iranian militias, that they are doing their own thing and you cannot stop them?
I think if nowadays you will talk with many political leaders, they started to talk about this. Many people, they didn't dare to talk about it. This is also a part of the reality in this country. But now we are talking about it and we are saying to them, stop there. People dare to say to those guys, is enough. I think all of them, they got the message that if they will continue, they will, in the first place, destroy the political process in Iraq, and they will push this country into a war, while it is not our war. And also the Iranian got the message.
How real is that danger that this tit-for-tat between the Iranians and the Americans on Iraqi soil could push this country into conflict?
That's the main problem, to be honest. The tension nowadays between Iran and United States is very high. So I hope both sides will stop their attacks on Iraqi soil, and they are not going to solve their problem on Iraqi soil. We paid a very big price.
Dr. Fuad Hussein, the Iraqi foreign minister, speaking to our senior international correspondent, Orla Gurin. Next to Pakistan. There is tension and uncertainty in the country as they continue to wait for the final results of Thursday's elections. On Saturday, police in the city of Talangang in the Punjab province used tear gas to push back crowds protesting against the delay. The demonstrators dispersed when they were told results would be finalised on Sunday. The parties of the jailed former Prime Minister Imran Khan and his rival Nawaz Sharif are both claiming victory. Mr. Sharif, who is thought to be favoured by the powerful military, has called on smaller parties to help him form a unity government. These people in Lahore urge the parties to get together to find a way forward.
We are right now in a very, very critical situation, both economically, security-wise, and on many other levels. So Pakistan political parties really need to sit together.
Pakistan can't afford any kind of conflict, which is why I keep repeating that we must all sit down together, settle these issues, and bring Pakistan into the 21st century.
The head of the army has also urged politicians to negotiate and show what he described as maturity and unity. Here's our correspondent in Islamabad, Caroline Davies.
There's growing unrest in Pakistan, where the full results of the election are yet to be released. Police in the city of Talegang in Punjab used tear gas to push back crowds protesting against the delay. Imran Khan's independents have more seats than his rival Nawaz Sharif's PMLN party, but Mr. Khan's supporters claim the vote has been rigged to deprive them of a clear majority. That is strongly denied by the authorities. At a news conference, Mr. Khan's party declared its intention to try to form a national government.
We are not fighting with anyone.
The chairman, Gohar Ali Khan.
We are not against any institution. This is our country. Every institution is so dear and near to us. We regard and respect every institution. We trust every institution. We are just asking them to respect this mandate of the public. That's all. Nothing more, nothing less.
But it is not the only party trying to form a government. Nawaz Sharif has called for other groups in parliament to form a coalition with his PMLN. The head of Pakistan's powerful army appears to want a coalition, saying that the country would be well represented by a unified government of all democratic forces. Many thought the military's favoured candidate was Mr. Sharif. The fact that he has fewer seats than his rival Imran Khan suggests that the army's backing was not enough to win.
Caroline Davies. Hungary's first female president, Katalin Novak, has resigned amid outrage over her decision to pardon a man convicted of covering up child sexual abuse. Ms. Novak, a close ally of the nationalist Prime Minister Viktor Orban, stepped down on live television. She told viewers she'd made a mistake.
I apologise to those whom I may have offended and to all the victims who might have felt that I didn't stand up for them. I have constantly advocated for the protection of children and families. Today marks my final address to you as president, as I tender my resignation from the post of President of the Republic.
Another leading female politician from the same party, Judith Varga, has also announced she's standing down. I heard more from our Central Europe correspondent, Nick Thorpe, who's in Budapest.
This was basically a presidential pardon issued last year on the occasion of the Pope's visit to Hungary. President Novak pardoned 25 people, and interestingly, their names were only just made public a week or so ago, and it turned out that one of them was a man convicted as an accomplice for helping cover up a sex abuse case in a children's home, so basically a pedophilia case. This has been it would be a scandal in any case, of course, but in this particular case, Katalin Novak, she's the former minister in charge of family policy, and as president, she's made, and her government, the Fidesz government, have made the traditional family and the protection of children a cornerstone of their policy.
And how serious is this for the government?
It's very serious, really, because not only has Katalin Novak resigned as president, but Judith Varga, another woman in Fidesz, a very high-ranking woman in Fidesz, who's the former justice minister, she also signed the same amnesty or clemency decision, and she was due to lead the Fidesz, the governing party's list, in the European elections this June. So Fidesz have lost its two most prominent female politicians, basically, you know, in a matter of days, over an issue which is deeply embarrassing and politically harmful for them. Clearly, this is an attempt at damage limitation by Prime Minister Viktor Orban, but it's nevertheless very embarrassing and a big blow for him and his government.
And briefly, it's significant that a senior female politician in Hungary has resigned in this way.
That's right. This is a very male-dominated society. There are only 29 women deputies in parliament. That's 14% against the European Union average. So a great shortage of women in politics. And for that reason, too, a big blow for Hungary as well, not just the governing party.
Nick Thorpe. Ukraine says 7 people have died in a Russian drone attack on the northeastern city of Kharkiv. The victims include a family of 5. From Kyiv, our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports.
The youngest of the children killed in the Russian drone attack was a baby. His brothers were 7 and 4. They all died in their home with their parents after a fire broke out and spread too quickly for them to escape. In another house, 2 pensioners were killed. A regional police chief has talked about a hellish lava of diesel and petrol pouring down the street after what's described as a large fuel depot nearby was hit by the drones. As the leak spread, it set fire to homes and cars on several streets. Dozens of people were evacuated and buildings destroyed. At least 10 drones were launched by Russia over Kharkiv in this attack, and 2 made it through Ukraine's air defense systems. The city is so close to the Russian border, there's little time to intercept missiles or drones when they're launched. That's why many children now study underground on the metro, and Kharkiv is even constructing a purpose-built school beneath a sports field, in case this war goes on even longer.
Sarah Rainsford in Ukraine. Still to come.
This mysterious vessel, this mysterious ship, just hit a big coral reef off the coast of Tobago. Huge amounts of oil washing up on the beach.
Now hundreds of people are working to try and save the local environment.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. To Indonesia now, where the final rallies have been held ahead of the presidential elections on Wednesday. More than 200 million Indonesians can vote in an election which will choose a successor to the popular outgoing president Widodo. He's not allowed to serve more than 2 terms. As Jonathan Head reports from Jakarta, there are concerns about the outcome of this election, as the favourite to win is a former general who's carried out human rights abuse, and his running mate is the current president's son.
Away from the noise and colour of the political rallies, a smaller protest gathers in front of the presidential palace in Jakarta. These are the families of those who died or disappeared in the chaotic last months of the authoritarian Suharto regime. They've been coming here every Thursday for 17 years, demanding answers. Among them is Payan, father of Uchok, a student who vanished in May 1998. We come here every week to make sure that human rights violators are not elected, he told me. And he showed me the words printed on the back of his T-shirt. Bring back the disappeared, don't let him rule the country. By him, he means this man. Prabowo Subianto is the front runner in this election, his third attempt at the presidency. To get here, he's needed an extraordinary transformation of his public image. This was Jakarta in May 1998. I was there. An orgy of looting and burning swept across the city as the 32-year rule of President Suharto collapsed. Blame for the violence and for the kidnapping of political activists was pinned on his son-in-law, Prabowo, then a fast-rising star in the military. He was dismissed from the army and went into exile. Now, with a slick social media campaign, he's portrayed as a cuddly, avuncular figure, a moderate who will continue the popular legacy of President Jokowi. It's been very successful, especially with younger Indonesians who know little of Prabowo's past. Well, all the candidates have their sins, says student Leonardis. Maybe he didn't carry out those kidnappings. Maybe he was just following orders. But it's President Jokowi's full endorsement of the former military hardman which has dismayed so many Indonesians. through a controversial court ruling, the president has got his son, Gibran, on the ticket as Praboa's running mate, even though he's below the constitutional age threshold.
You know, you cannot allow democracy to be on autopilot. It needs to be constantly reinvigorated.
Dewi Fortuna Anwar has been an advisor to presidents and vice presidents. She worries about this nepotistic step by Jokowi.
A lot of democracy activists say, you know, well, Jokowi is not that concerned about democracy. He's a businessman, you know. So he's still forgiven in a way, even though it costs Indonesia's democracy, but it is a collective mistake for us. But by making it personal, Jokowi has in fact tarnished his own image, his own reputation.
25 years after the first post-Suharto election, Indonesians appear to have lost none of their enthusiasm for their young democracy. Compared to many others in the region, it is still in rude health. But few would disagree that it's certainly less free and less accountable than it used to be, and that a figure like Prabowo Subianto makes a very unlikely saviour.
Jonathan Head. A growing environmental disaster could be unfolding off the coast of Trinidad and Tobago. Hundreds of volunteers and emergency workers are trying to clean up a massive oil spill after a ship overturned a few days ago after hitting a coral reef. The government says at least 15 kilometres of coastline on the Atlantic coast have been affected. I heard more from our Latin America regional editor, Leonardo Rocha.
Well, it happened on Wednesday. This mysterious ship just hit a big coral reef off the coast of Tobago, in the southwestern side of the island. The crew escaped. They are trying to identify who are the owners of this ship called the Gulfstream. They already know the name of the ship. But what happens then, you have huge amounts of oil washing up on the beach and in nearby areas. So I've seen pictures online, you see footage, and you have the government there saying that 15 kilometers of coastline in the area of Tobago have been affected. They are trying to do what they can to contain, because with oil spills, the main thing is to try to contain as quickly as possible.
Is there any history of oil spills in this area?
From what I heard, I haven't heard about any recent oil spills there. But from what I heard, it's a busy area because Trinidad and Tobago has oil. Now Guyana has oil. And if you look on the map, Trinidad and Tobago is just next to Venezuela. And it's a busy route for oil tankers. So from the comments I read, people saying we have to be careful. These sort of things can happen here all the time. It's completely uncontrolled. It's an accident that can happen. But the damage for the island can be huge. I mean, they deployed volunteers. They're trying to establish this perimeter where they put devices to contain it and basically to clean up the oil. But it comes at a very bad time for the island, which is just before Carnival.
And how significant is the carnival there?
Well, Trinidad and Tobago has a famous carnival. It's one of the best carnivals or the most popular in the Caribbean. And officially, the carnival there is on Monday and Tuesday. So the weekend is when you have all the tourists arriving. You have resorts around the area that where people travel to, not only to for the carnival, but because of the holiday season. What the hotel management group there is saying, people who represent the hotels, is that they're very concerned and many people might be put off. They had a cruise ship arriving there and everyone was warned, 3,000 tourists, they were warned to be careful where they went on, you know, because there'd been an oil spill. So it creates a very bad image for the island. And more immediately, many people might cancel their plans to go to the island. There was a local carnival festivity that was cancelled. And people are very concerned because this is a lifeline for many people who work on the industry, for tourist guides, for taxi drivers, for the small hotels and for the big resorts.
Leonardo Rocha. Now, here's an item for those who are fortunate enough to enjoy gourmet cooking. The best chefs in the world generally consider it an honour for their restaurants to be listed in the Michelin Guide. This is published by the French tire company Michelin, and it's updated each year to list what it regards as the finest restaurants. The very best get rated with 3 stars, but just getting 1 star is seen as a major achievement and a mark of global recognition. Adeyoke Bakare is the first black woman in the UK to be awarded a Michelin star, and only the second in the world. She's the Nigerian-born founder and head chef at Chizuru, a restaurant which specialises in West African cooking in London. Adeyoke gave us her thoughts on why the restaurant has achieved such recognition.
I think people could connect to the fact that we're sharing our heritage and people could see themselves on the table, and it didn't feel or look like something that was inaccessible. So case in point, there is this dish that we had on, we still have it on, but it's in a different form, called Senasa. And Senasa is very popular around northern Nigeria and across parts of northern West Africa. And I've forgotten what she called it. She must be Indian, South Indian. And she came in and she ate it. And she said, I eat it every morning when I was growing up. So it's that connection with people on the dining table, I think, was what people found and what people loved.
See many people there outside where they feed man's oboe. Oh no. And me a standy defender like Joseph Yobo.
Most people that come here haven't had the food before, but people could see bits that remind them of themselves. Because I think before, West African food has been seen as this fairly scary, inaccessible thing. But when people come, they see that part of it, tell their friends. And for us, mostly, it has been word of mouth. It's been somebody coming in, eating, liking it, recommending it to their friends, and going, oh, you should go there because they have this version, this West African version of this thing that we have.
If you fall in love, Kelly Satin, you go to breakfast, I'm not capping. Can you see Dripple and Mokachi?
Well, with this now, thank God, they'll start looking into the continent itself. There are loads of young cooks doing fantastic things. And I don't know, I just think maybe because when it comes to, say, Chinese, Japanese, Korean food, people visit, they go on holidays and come back and try and recreate those things that they have. I think with more people going on holidays, there's a lot of people now going to Ghana and whatever, eating food and coming back and thinking, oh, I want to try this. As much as we want people to have it, for me, it is also about the history, so that it's not diluted so much that it loses itself. Because sometimes some of those brands, it just becomes a thing of profits and whatever. I think people come thinking it's going to be fine dining, and we're not. What we're doing in Chizuru basically is just sharing food of my heritage. And I'm cooking it the same way my grandma would cook it. It's just a continuation of that.
Adeyoke Bakare. Finally, to football, and the hosts Qatar have won the Asian Cup. The reigning champions beat the underdogs Jordan by 3-1, and they defended their title with a remarkable hat-trick of penalties by Akram Afif, who became the tournament's top scorer. The BBC's Puria Jaffere watched the game in Doha and told me the tournament will be remembered for a number of shock results.
Everybody thought this is going to be a Japan-South Korea final. If not, maybe other ones like Iran, Saudi or Australia can make it to the final. But in the end, we have two Arab teams from this region making it to the final. The stadium was full, and this is something I've been coming here for a long time. This is something which doesn't happen here very often. I've seen Qatar games which happened in very smaller stadiums with 10,000, 12,000 capacity. And this time it was full.
And of course, as you say, it's just a year on from the World Cup in Qatar. There were question marks about the passion for football in that country. How has this tournament been received there?
It's very different that they kind of managed to do what they couldn't do at the World Cup. This time they were prepared, they were ready, and they used their home advantage to the best to win the championship.
And just finally, as you say, Qatar did not play well at the World Cup, but they are now back-to-back Asian Cup champions. What does this say about the strength of football in Asia?
I was amazed. This is my 7th Asian Cup, covering some of them for the BBC since 2011. And the quality of football was amazing. And I'm not just saying about Qatar or Jordan. You had the smaller teams coming up, getting results. There was Malaysia for the first time drawing with South Korea. And this is a South Korea who have top players like Son Heung-min of Tottenham or Hwang of Wolverhampton Wanderers. You had Japan losing to Iraq. Let's not forget Japan have like some of the top players in the Premier League. And you could see that football is growing in this part of the world.
Puria Jaffare in Qatar. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nigel Adderley. Until next time, goodbye.